Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Walt and I had a house fire. We had left for work that morning. We carpooled to work. It was a normal day. And y'all know how that goes. Anytime somebody says it was a day like any other, that means something's about to go down. Well, about mid-morning, I got a call from the fire chief saying, "Cheryl, y'all need to get home. Your house is on fire." And I was like, "Well, chief, do I need to rush or is there just nothing left? I mean, tell me what's going on." And he said, "No, it's a pretty good fire, but there's a lot that's been salvaged." Well, when I got home, of course, all our neighbors were in the front yard and everybody's there, the fire trucks and the police, everybody. And to me, the fire had done a lot of damage. But the fire department, with their water and the way they dropped the ceilings and busted into the walls to make sure there wasn't any other embers that could have a secondary fire later, I mean, the house just looked totally destroyed to me. Our neighbor's house actually caught fire and the flames came over to our house. So it wasn't even anything we had anything to do with, but it was still a really strange feeling when you're, you know, getting interviewed and questioned by an arson investigator. We have somebody so fantastic with us, Aphrodite Jones. She is a TV personality. She's a best-selling author. She has worked for over 30 years to bring us up close and personal with some of the darkest motives and just these emotional type truths behind these crimes. She was the host of True Crime with Aphrodite Jones for 6 seasons, a remarkable show. Her best-selling books have been turned into acclaimed films like the award-winning Boys Don't Cry, and then the Netflix hit, The Staircase. She has made regular appearances on CNN, CBS, Fox News, MSNBC, and 2020, just to name a few. I first met her at CrimeCon, and let me tell you something. Smart, quick-witted, and a whole lot of fun, but also so approachable for people. It is an honor for me to welcome to Zone 7, Aphrodite Jones.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's my honor to be here. I love your work. I love what you do, helping people solve cold cases. It's amazing. And just today, we hear about Natalie Holloway, you know, killer coming forward. I know you worked on that to start with. And I really, really am proud to be on the show with you.
Thank you so much. And yeah, that was a wonderful day, wasn't it? We have all worked with Beth and, you know, sent her good vibes and prayed for her and tried to support her. So I know you've done that well since 2005.
Amen on that. I was covering the Michael Jackson case when that Natalie, the report of her missing came out. That was the last day of the trial. And the next thing you knew, everybody flew out to Aruba. But it's just what's interesting to me about that, just to get off topic for a minute, is that you never really get a confession out of a killer. It's very rare that they'll admit to anything. Certainly in this news story I have written, you know, there's no confession. It's all about, "I didn't do it. I'll prove it," you know. And I just find it unusual. Don't you?
It's extremely unusual. And again, you know, as you know, it's something that Beth has literally begged for. Just tell me. If I'm not going to get her back, tell me. And so I saw great peace on her face the other day. She was a different person.
She looks relieved, and she said that it's some form of closure. She understands that victims don't like the word closure. She's an ultimate victim. But, you know, when I say the ultimate victim, for her to have to beg and plead and spend 18 years knowing who the killer is, you know, I mean, there's many people that are in cold cases that they don't know who did this horrible thing, you know, or they're not sure or they don't have answers. This, we knew it was Vandersloot. We knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out and said as much in one of those documentaries. Remember way back when somebody caught him in Germany or something?
Yeah.
Right?
He confessed several times.
Yeah. So, you know, just the idea that he had never been in federal custody before. He had not, they had no opportunity to bring him to America because Aruba would not let the FBI in there to do anything, even though they're standing by it. You know this better than anyone. I'm sure your listeners do as well. But think about how convoluted it is that he could not be tried in America for anything other than extorting money from Natalie's mother. Thank God that happened. But again, he yes. didn't have to give the details. For me, you know, I look at what makes a killer tick. And in his case, there's two things. First of all, he committed that second murder 5 days to the date, on the same date, as you know, right? A lot of people don't realize that. You know, we in the crime world, we understand, we notice it, but people don't realize, oh, really? They were the same date? Yeah, they were the same date. What is he trying to signal there? He's trying to tell you, I got away with it. Here I am on the same date. I won't get away with it again. And then the other thing, too, is I think he's so desperate for attention. Now that he has given this horrendous confession, we're all talking about him again.
And, you know, he gave great details on Stephanie Flores's murder. Once he was caught, he wanted to tell these details. So to me, he's either doing it because he has some kind of gratification from it, or he's doing it because he knows he's going to go to prison and he wants some street cred.
I think it's the first. I think he gets gratification from it. I truly do. I mean, killing once out of passion is one thing. Killing twice, you're a serial killer. That's it. I mean, he would kill again. He would kill again, I'm sure of it, you know?
100%.
So
100%.
He enjoyed it. And he enjoyed it, and he enjoyed the tease, and he enjoyed all of it, and he enjoyed being able to discuss people with the details, the gritty, nitty, horrifying details.
I agree, and I think 2043, we need to be on alert, because he will kill again.
Yeah. Yes, he will. God knows. Anyway, by that time, I won't be here.
Well, let's talk about your book. So here's the deal. You have written a book, and it's an in-depth, twisted case over a great period of time. And I said to you that you have written a beautiful book. And even though it's about murder and, you know, horrible things, it can be beautiful in the way that you write it, in the way that you describe things. And I just want to start the way you start the book. And the book is Levi's Eyes. And I'm quoting, "The guy was all over the map. He was like a flowing river, running into tributaries, into countless streams and creeks." Now that's just beautiful, Aphrodite. And it gives you this undeniable vision of, yes, this person is telling you things. He's telling you what happened, but he's all over the place, and he's down this creek, and he's down this river, and he's going in different directions. Immediately, you had me.
Yeah, well, you know, I had certainly, I think I raised my bar for myself with this book. I really went for something more like a novel than I'd ever had before, even that I'm using the real facts. And that's hard to do because, you know, you walk a fine line between I have interviews with the people, the real people, the police reports, the court transcripts, I was at the trial, et cetera, et cetera. So you're dealing with real documents, 3,000 pages of them in this case, and, you know, and photos and news clips and this and that. And then on top of it, I want to make it so that you're living this story. You're actually in the story. And in order to do that, I really had to stretch myself as a writer. I truly did, Cheryl. There were a lot of growing pains that went on with this one, I got to tell you.
Your process, the way you investigate a case, how do you start? What do you look for? Do you wait for a case to grab you? Do you wait for a twist that you can't walk away from? How do you do it?
First of all, okay, so the Long Island serial killer, Gilgo Beach killer, lives about 15 minutes from where I am right now. And I spend time up here in New York, and I'm here now. And I was asked, you know, by one of the radio station people here, you know, go over there. And the DA wants to talk to media, you know, he wants a book, blah, blah, blah. So I went over there and I did some man on the street interviews with neighbors, and it was horrifying. But at the end of the day, I can't do that book. That is not, there's no book there. Why? Because who is the book going to be about? The only person of interest to me would be his wife and how she did or did not know or figured it out later. And actually, this is why the book I've written now, Levi's Eyes, is so significant, is because for the first time ever, I have the wife, the second wife, who lived the inside of this, not knowing she was married to a killer, and ultimately figuring out not only did he kill her stepson, Levi, his son, but also he had a life insurance policy out on his grandchildren, on her, that someone was going to be next. I mean, thinking that and understanding. So if you were in the Gilgo Beach serial killer's house and you had the opportunity to get into the wife's head and the kids' heads, you know, then you have a story. But otherwise, it's just gratifying the ego of a monster. I don't want to do that. That's my last thing I want to do in life. So that wouldn't be a project for me. But here, you know, two things, Cheryl. One is I had covered this story for my show, True Crime on ID, in 2014. So next year will be 10 years ago. It was right after he had confessed to killing his son. He took copped a second degree murder plea. And I did this story. I was up in the Finger Lakes area, upstate New York, and we filmed it. And Carl had written to me back then, the killer, you know, I want to talk to you. And I was, you know, in the midst of show after show after show, I couldn't talk to him in the middle of filming. It just didn't work out that way. But in any event, I knew one thing, and that was his first wife had died in a fire, tragic fire, back in 1991 in California. And there was no doubt in my mind that this was now going to be re-examined. And in fact, it had been ruled an accident. It was never a cold case. It was reopened after he confessed to murdering his son. And then we're all waiting for that trial. Where's the trial in California? What's happening? Years are going by. He doesn't get extradited until 2016. He's serving prison for the murder of his son. They finally get enough to extradite him to California, and they're going to try him for murder of his first wife, Christina Carlson, in California. And then that drags on until the summer of 2019. That's when I'm ready to go there, because at that point, I'm talking to Carl Carlson on the phone. And I have a relationship, quote unquote, with this monster who thinks that I like him, which, of course, got to make them think that, you know, I understand you. Yeah, I understand you. Bottom line, that trial continued to get postponed until January of 2020. But when that happened, I was there and I was ready. And man, what a dramatic scene that was, to be in a place called San Andreas, California, and watch people testify about something that had happened almost 30 years before.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper, wear it like no one else.
Something that's so critical for people to understand about cold cases, you literally work them backwards. So you are making a relationship with this person so that you can get intel, you can get information, you can get quotes, you can understand the story. And then you've got to go backwards in time and understand, okay, what was going on 30 years ago? So one thing that they did that I found fascinating in your book is when the investigators, the arson investigators, wanted to make sure that his account was accurate. So they interview the 6-year-old daughter.
Erin. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. They did interview her and they couldn't get a full statement out of her. She was so young. And then what did Carl do? Now, this man already had a plan. This was not an accident. This was a planned arson. And so he had taken life insurance out on his wife, you know, weeks prior in the amount of $200,000. Now think about that. And this was the winter of 1990. He killed her on New Year's Day, 1991. Think about $200,000 in 1990. You can triple that to today's rates, right? It would be equivalent to probably $1 million today. Okay. That is a lotto for him. That is lottery money for him. That's who his wife was to him, a lottery ticket. It's frightening and horrifying that, you know, this is how this man thought, but there's more to that story. You know that.
Always more. There's always more. But you do such a great job. You include the autopsy results, so you're very clear. There was heavy soot on the upper torso, back, and posterior legs. Only the right side of her face had been burned. The trachea and larynx showed thermal damage. So the cause of death was simple asphyxiation caused by inhaling smoke. But then you make it clear that, you know, the manner was undetermined. But then you go on and you say, look, y'all, the bathroom window had been broken. He said he made a quick repair that included 17 nails. I thought that was so brilliant because you're painting a picture without saying a word more. You are not saying he freaking killed his wife. But when you read 17 nails, we've all watched somebody do a quick repair like, oh, the window's busted, so I'm going to put this over it to protect animals from getting in or the cold. It don't take 17 nails to do that.
No. And in fact, you know, one of the things I point out in the book, Carl met Christina, his first wife, when he worked on the military base in North Dakota. So here he is, Grand Forks Naval Air Force Base, rather, and he's a person who, get this, he's in the nuclear warheads program. He's charged with driving around nuclear warheads to stealth locations in the wilds of Wyoming and North Dakota. Okay. Missile locations, underground missile. So here you have this man. He meets Christina. She's married to somebody else. She went there with her first husband, who was also in the Air Force. He swooped her off her feet. He stole her basically from the first husband. But aside from that, and same thing with Cindy, the second wife, she was also just out of a divorce and he was yanking her away from that husband. You know, he liked that idea, but he presented himself as this, you know, superhero. You know, he's driving nuclear warheads around. He's involved with the missile program. He's going to be the, you know, biggest deal there ever was in the Air Force. I mean, he really thought that about himself, a huge ego. But when you talk about the nails on the window, what's interesting is there's a picture in the book. You wouldn't understand it until you read the book, but there's a photo of just icicles hanging and you can't tell what it is. But I write in the caption, this is a photo of the icicles that are hanging from the window of Christina's place in North Dakota. And she wrote under it, look at our icicles. Why is that important? Well, her first husband, Alan Teets, gave me that photo. And in that photo, what you realize is that window is covered with a plastic, a clear film plastic, because in the zero and minus 30 degrees of North Dakota in the winter, that's how people covered their windows to keep cold out. They didn't use a plywood. They didn't have a piece of plywood and staple it on there with 17 nails. No. So the whole thing, you know, when you think about that, you know, the whole thing, how she didn't see through what he was trying to do to her is another matter, you know, because Cindy, the second wife, also didn't see through what he was doing to her. He's a shapeshifter.
Well, let's talk about some of those things. They had four smoke detectors. And he had taken the batteries out. He had taken them down and taken the batteries out of all four.
Exactly. And of course, he said, no, I didn't do that. That must have fallen. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, all four fail and all four batteries popped out. Absolutely. And then there's the kerosene. And this might be one of my favorites that I've ever heard. So he buys this 2 gallon or 5 gallon, sorry, a 5 gallon jug of kerosene. And he blames her for bringing it in the house. He says she did it. And then when they say, well, why would she bring a 5 gallon jug of kerosene into your house? He says, well, we would sometimes, or I would sometimes use it and put water in the empty kerosene can so we would have extra water. And then they went, you put water in a kerosene can? He said, oh, yeah, just to pour, you know, in the toilet to flush it if the pipes were frozen. I mean, your reaction should have been their reaction.
I know. Well, believe me, they couldn't laugh in his face, but you knew damn well when they were asking that, when they were seriously investigating an arson and they're questioning this man, okay, for them to say, in other words, what he, and just to get a little more of a tweak here, this is how convoluted it was, Cheryl. He says, that 5 gallon kerosene jug, I brought up from the shop. And we used it and filled it with water because our pipes were frozen. And so that's why Christina brought it into the house, because she was filling up our toilets and showers with water. So then the investigator says, well, then why is there kerosene back in the jug? Oh, well, because then we put kerosene back into the jug that we had the water in. What? So in other words, kerosene turns to water, turns to kerosene again. And it's all Chris's fault because she didn't understand what she was bringing into the house because, you know, she's an idiot.
Absolutely, 100%. And then 5 gallons of kerosene gets spilled and, you know, the victim, again, being an idiot, takes the brand new Christmas clothes. And that's what... And that's what she soaks it up with.
It's a terrifying and horrifying story. But these are things about this particular mind of this psychopath that really make your head spins. It's so preposterous what he's saying. And he wants you to believe it. And, you know, I interviewed him for 2 years and I have those recorded phone calls. And let me tell you, when you hear him say it, you're just like, I'm sitting there talking to this guy. I'm thinking, is this really coming out of this man's mouth? Like, is he kidding? Is he not? Yeah. He says, oh, yeah, no, we used to. And of course, I'd question him on it again and again to get him, you know, try to round him in a corner. And I said, well, so you used Christmas clothes? That was the closest thing there was. So Christina, who made her own clothes for her kids from handmade patterns, right, is going to take that clothes that she spent God knows how long creating, and she's just going to use that to soak up some kerosene in the hallway real quick.
That's what we would all do. Absolutely.
Hey, I can't wait to use my next Christmas gifts so that I can, you know, mop the floors with them.
That's right. How does Aphrodite Jones clean her house with brand new clothes? I mean, it's just asinine.
And it's so crazy. And the thing is, he wants you to believe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He wants you to believe it. Now, when 6-year-old Erin was interviewed by the fire investigators, she told them she didn't know there was any kerosene in the floor. They're kids. They don't know what they're smelling and not smelling. But she did say there were a pile of clothes in the floor, sheets and towels and clothes and whatever that they used to play leapfrog over. So what that tells me is that did happen. A spill happened, and he deliberately made that happen so there'd be multiple accounts of kerosene all over the place, right? And then the kids, clearly, he did put some clothes down, not new clothes, probably old rags. And a 6-year-old wasn't sure what it was she was jumping over, whether it was blankets or something, you know. And then, of course, what did Carl do? He takes those kids and leaves for New York, flies away from where they lived in Murphy's, California, the day after Christina's memorial. So within 4 days of her death, he's grabbed his 3 kids and moved to New York, flown away. And he didn't even let his kids go to their mother's memorial service.
Well, because they might talk to somebody. They might say something. So you can't let that happen. Then you got to get them out of there as fast as you can. But my favorite thing after that is the picture that you paint of him calling the insurance agent. And to your point, he just has no sense of what he's really telling people. So now he's saying, man, I need that check to come on through because I had to spend $6,000 on plane tickets. Then there's the funeral. And now I'm, you know, it's a bitch, quote, it's a bitch raising three kids by myself.
First of all, so he didn't pay for the plane tickets. We discover that later. His brother paid for the plane tickets, and his brother, Mike Carlson, testified to that. And it's in evidence. The credit card receipt from the travel agency voucher, that those were all paid by his brother, number one. And never paid back by Carl. Number two, there was no funeral expenses to pay for. He didn't have a funeral for her. How about that? He didn't have a funeral for her. There was a memorial service, not a real funeral. She was later buried. He didn't even put a tombstone on her grave.
So let's talk about the insurance policy that was attached to the wife.
He went into the insurance agent in California and said, I would like to inquire about insurance on my wife. And the insurance agent said, well, wait a minute, you have insurance on you? Yeah, I do. No, he did not. He's lying. And the insurance agent says, well, you know, you can't take insurance out on your wife unless she's here with you. And you have to prove to me that you've got insurance on yourself. So, of course, Carl didn't have insurance on himself. He was lying. But he brought Christina in there and somehow convinced her to take out a $200,000 insurance policy on herself and he took one out on himself. And the thing is, I don't know why didn't the insurance agent have a light bulb go off that he later testified in the 40 years that he had been in the business, he never had someone walk in off the street and solicit getting life insurance for themselves or anyone else. He says that's something that people always have to be sold on. You go and you call about car insurance, you call about house insurance. You don't call about, can I get some life insurance? That's what I need, you know?
And Aphrodite, he wanted insurance on the children. Most people would never be able to utter those words that I want insurance on my children in case they die.
That's what really starts to make you wonder, what was it he was going to do there that day in that fire in California? He got Levi out, or Levi got out, which is it? What did Levi see? What did Levi know? Why did Levi get killed 17 years later when he was 23 years old? All that is a thread that comes together.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Slowly, investigators start to see some things, and some things come out, like Carl was abusive maybe toward Chris by pushing her out of her chair and things like that. You know, you start chapter 15 with something that every single person in criminal justice would attest to immediately. And you say, and I quote, whether we like to admit it or not, everybody lies. And you go on to say that with Carl, his lies become truth, and the truth becomes lies, and he takes pleasure in confusing everybody.
That is so true. You know, this is, and you find this, you've dealt with killers, you know, so many years. The worst of a sociopath that you're dealing with, and, you know, I say, look at Vandersloot as an example. These are next level sociopaths. Okay. This is, you know, going into, you know, I some kind of stratosphere of sociopaths, I suppose. In any event, they are all about riddles, confusing, mixing, matching. Everything coming out of their mouth is a lie. That's how you know that when they're talking, you know that's how you know they're lying, because their lips are moving. Like Judge Judy says, if the lips are moving, it's a lie. This guy, and that's the thing. He'll tell you a story, and it comes out throughout the book. I'm sure you've seen it, where he starts telling one thing, and then you realize, wait a minute, he said something different about this whole scenario you know, the month before, the year before. He just changes the story. Like, what do you, it's unbelievable. He really, a pathological sociopath, liar.
And sometimes he's just grotesque with it, because when the arson investigator says, hey, you know, your wife died and you made a little money, he says, wait a minute. And I quote, I mean, let's face it. I had $100,000 on all three of them. If I was going to do it, I'd have to let them go too, because then I wouldn't have to be a mommy.
Unbelievable. So the plan was, he says, okay, he saved his three kids, so this way he can get away with murdering his wife, right? That's one way to look at it. Or was the plan he was going to kill everybody to begin with?
And, you know, they go on to say, and you already mentioned this too, what really happened with Levi, because when they ask him, did any of the kids see you at the broken window? He says, I think Levi did. So in other words, he knows Levi was somewhere different than the girls. He had more of an opportunity to see what all transpired before the girls ever got out.
Exactly. And, you know, there are other things. And if you've read the whole book, you know there are other weird things in the relationship between Levi and his father.
Very twisted. And I think that's when even the counselor starts saying, Levi won't talk to me. He won't talk about his mama at all. And then later, he becomes, you know, that kid that anybody can see is struggling. He's smoking pot. He's stealing money. He's now goth. I mean, he's got a lot of issues that he's not even trying to hide that he has them.
And of course, you know, all of this is fodder for Carl to say, you know, this kid is a loser. He's a waste of a life. And Carl's very good at that, of, you know, demeaning people and making people feel like they're worthless. And, it's just comes in the package with his inability to show any emotions at all, or have any real sense of value of a human life. He just had none. Human life, animal life, no life means anything to him.
And you know, as I was reading the book, there was one part where I just wanted to text you and say, stop it. Why are you making me go through this? Because I was already locked in on Carl, right? And then you're like, hey, y'all, by the way, he had a car fire before the house fire. Now, y'all, listen to me. I almost had to text her and tell her I'm not happy with you right this minute, Aphrodite, because you're telling me that Carl now is telling a whole different fire department, hey, I just drove my car home and went in the house, and then my wife at the time realized the car just burst into flames right there in our driveway.
Right, after I took the baby seats and carriages out of it.
Yeah, because, you know, those are expensive to replace.
Right. After he removed all the baby seats and everything else out of the car, it combusted. It's like a natural disaster just occurred in his driveway.
And thank God he had the foresight to say, you know, I'm going to get a safe that protects paperwork, but I'm going to keep it in the garage. And then when that arson investigator asked me, why is this safe in the garage, not in the house? Because if your house burns down, your garage doesn't. Like,
oh,
I'm going to throw this book out the window. I was like, I can't read anymore. I'm getting so irritated. But then I couldn't stop because I knew what inevitably was coming. And I thought, oh my gosh. And then it just goes on.
You can't believe what comes out of this guy's mouth, right?
And every time he gets insurance money, every time he gets a check, here's a check for your car, here's a check for your house, here's a check for your wife. And I mean, you're just like, okay, so then he gets this big pile of money and he buys a big old farm with horses and a barn and all kind of acreage. And you're like, he is now succeeding. Because their mama was killed and he's got a new wife that he moves in there. And he's asked one time, and I want y'all to listen to this quote. He is asked by, I believe, his sister-in-law, something about rats. And he goes, hey, do you know how an arsonist gets away with a fire? You douse a rat in kerosene, light it, and it always runs back to its home.
Yeah, which its home is a pile of hay. So it's just going to light up that barn fire. And he's letting that sister know, yeah, I killed your sister. It gives me chills. Really, that makes my hair stand on its end when I hear you say it, because I can feel it. You know, I can feel it. How he really just was enjoying those moments where all of a sudden it wasn't preposterous. All of a sudden he gets real, you know, kind of like Vandersloot. All of a sudden, oh, well, let me tell you. This is, you know, here's a good clue for you here. That's a sickness of a psychopath. You know, they want, it's like the BTK. I was at Dennis Rader's sentencing. He wanted to take credit for it all. After 30 years of torturing everybody in the city of Wichita, after 30 years of being undercover, being in hiding, coming in and out of hiding, he, at the end of it all, wanted to take credit. He stood up there, Cheryl, in that courtroom, and I was there, proud as he could be, referring to himself as Dennis Rader in the third person. And I mean, really?
I mean, you have literally covered everything, and you didn't do it from a distance. You've been right up close and personal the whole time. And that's why when I got to this part in the book, because I kept thinking, you know what? I think I know what's coming with the sun, but we're not there yet. And all of a sudden you say, it's 2 a.m., November 3rd, 2002. And all of a sudden Carl is screaming, call 911. The barn is on fire. And I'm like, I am so done right this minute. This man cannot have set another fire. And just like the car, you go on to say there were these prize, you know, what are they called, Aphrodite? The things for the horses.
Tack.
Tack.
Yes.
And he had taken all these prize possessions, these, you know, irreplaceable tacks that were custom done. Oh, he had removed them from the barn.
Yeah, the saddles, the boots, the horse, all of the gear, all of the tack was all removed. Yeah, that somehow that didn't get destroyed. That was in a different place now. The creepiest part of that, and I don't like to give away so much of the book, but I will say this because it does make my head spin. I blow off of its head, is that at one point, his younger son, Alex, who he had with Cindy, his second wife, is standing in the driveway waiting for the school bus, or they're playing hoops, whatever it is, in the front of the house in New York. And now the horse fire had happened. Alex, the child, loved the horse that died. Ginger was her name. And he loved that horse and the other horses too, but especially Ginger. And now the fire's over, the horses died, ba-da-da, he got away with it, it was considered an accident. He's playing ball and hoops in the driveway waiting for the bus with his kid. And Alex finds the hoof of Ginger in the dirt next to the driveway there in the farm. Think about that for a minute.
That's beyond twisted.
And a kid that was like, he was a kid. He was born in 1995, so in 2002, what is he, 7 years old?
And that was his pet.
Well,
for all purposes.
Yes and no, but yeah, it was. Ginger was there to be bred. Turned out that she was unable to breed. So hence, what she's not very useful anymore. Hence, maybe we should have a fire. And of course, Carl upped the insurance on the horses right before the fire. But I mean, it's like, how do these people in these insurance agencies not know this? But they did know it, but they couldn't catch him. Of course they knew it. They're looking at the policies. They're seeing he took this policy out. He changed numbers 2 weeks prior, 4 weeks prior, 3 weeks prior, on every one of these cases. But they couldn't pin it to him.
Now, I want to tell everybody, you need to go get Levi's Eyes, because this book, as much as we have talked about it already, it is not over. His crimes are not over. What has all fixing to transpire with Levi, you will not believe it. It is important to read it. To me, it's one of those cases where you can see what's coming down Peachtree Street, and at some point, this person should have been stopped. I think his family knew it. I think friends knew it. I think the children knew it, and they couldn't stop this in time.
Exactly. No question. No question about that. There's some blood on a lot of people's hands in this once you get through the whole story.
Looking for a fabulous fashion brand that celebrates you? Then look no further than Boston Proper, where styles are designed with you in mind, so you can look and feel amazing, no matter the day, season, or occasion. At bostonproper.com, you'll find fashion that knows you best. For over 30 years, Boston Proper has been the fashion destination for confident women who want to elevate their look with unique, sophisticated clothing at affordable prices. Visit bostonproper.com today. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.
Okay, so before I let you go, let's talk a little bit. What is one of your favorite cases? And I know how that sounds, but you know what I mean by it. What is one of the worst cases? What is a dream case? What is, you tell us anything you want us to know about your background and maybe future projects.
The favorite thing I ever had in the crime world was being with O.J. Simpson in Las Vegas when he was being tried there for, kidnapping and et cetera with the gun. And in the hallway outside the courtroom, I happened to know somebody he played football with. So I mentioned it and we made the phone call and he got all excited and happy. And next thing you know, it was my girlfriend's birthday and I had OJ sing happy birthday to her.
See,
that's a highlight right there.
That's a once in a career. That's a once in a career move.
That doesn't come around ever again. No. And in fact, when he did it, the good part about it was when he did it, so my girlfriend knew I was in Las Vegas. She knew I was at that trial. And she knew that. She didn't know I was hanging out with OJ in the hallway. But I handed the phone over. I said, somebody wants to sing happy birthday to you. And he sang it. And I'm watching. And then she asked him, obviously, she said, who is this? And he said, it's OJ. Like, she just wanted to hear him say it. I'm thinking to myself, who do you think it? I mean, his voice was still very recognizable. You know, you knew it was him. But I said to her, why didn't you ask him that? You knew it was him. She said, I know. I just wanted him to tell me. That's one. Another thing that always stays with me is the JonBenet. I interviewed John Ramsey for about an hour and a half. We had lunch in Las Vegas. I was trying to convince him to do my show. I did an episode on JonBenet back in, was it season three, season two of my show? Any event, long time ago now, probably 10 years ago. Anyway, he became such an interesting subject to me because I started to believe that Patsy had convinced him. She found a way to make it look like somebody was in that house. And I believe that John Ramsey truly was unaware. And I think what brings that full circle for me is the interview that his son Burke did with Dr. Phil McGraw. It's, if you notice, once that was done and the CBS thing special aired a series pointing to the son, you notice none of that has ever aired again, ever. You can't find it on the internet anywhere. In my mind, I believe that Patsy Ramsey figured out a way to keep her husband out of the loop because I don't think she thought he could act the part. And this is just my theory, but I really hold to it because I spent a lot of time with this man and I fully believe that he does not know who killed his kid. Now, how could that be? He thinks somebody came to the house. What? How could that be? Unless Patsy used a mind game with him. And I believe she did. I truly do.
The thing that always has bothered me the most, like, let's just say I have a little dog, Traveler. And let's say Traveler got lost. If I heard my husband, Walt, say, I found her, I would take that to mean, she's okay. You found her. When John is coming up the steps, he hollers, I found her. And Patsy drops to her knees and screams, no, not my baby.
That's exactly in line with what I'm talking about.
You and I are in sync there.
Yep. I mean, and people don't really see that. They think that John, you know, was a party to it. I don't think he was a party to it. I truly don't. So that case sticks with me because I really do wish, like, we finally got this answer from Euron Vandersloot, you know? And there is something so satisfying, mortifying and satisfying all at the same time. But at least you have an answer, as Beth Twitty said. You have an answer. You have a confession. You have a sense of there's some justice in this world, you know? But in the JonBenet case, there's nothing. Just have emptiness. This gorgeous little child. And then the whole sexualization of her, which back then, you know, girls in makeup and outfits at 6 years old were considered to be unheard of. Now we have princesses and tiaras and every other thing. And my granddaughters run around in makeup at 8 years old and dance classes and dance recitals. I mean, I don't know. When I grew up as a kid, I was in a dance recital. I had one tutu. I'd have 18 outfits that cost $200 a piece with all kinds of crazy makeup and eyelashes and everything. I mean, things have gotten very different, obviously, for young children, girls in particular, in that regard. But back then, the rags, the tabloids, were blaming John Ramsey for sexualizing his daughter. And, you know, I mean, how horrible is that? He had nothing to do with it, you know, by the way. He did tell me, you know, Patsy had cancer. She knew it. And that she took JonBenet to Manhattan when JonBenet was five. Because she felt she wouldn't have the opportunity to do that with her child later on because she felt she would die early. So she already had a sense of her own demise, you know? She knew she was sick. And you don't take a five-year-old to New York City by yourself unless you're thinking, you know, it didn't ever occur to me until he told me that. Thinking to myself, wow, you know, that Patsy realized she didn't have a lot of time on this earth with her kids. I don't know. I really, really wish that there would be an answer, but I have a feeling that that answer would not help the family, if you know what I mean.
So Aphrodite, I cannot thank you enough for being with us tonight and your extraordinary career and your fantastic stories and the way that you tell them is so necessary for justice.
Thank you for saying that, Cheryl. I really do appreciate it because at the end of the day, you know, what is it all about? It's for me, it's all about finding a way to make this world a safer place, inch by inch, person by person. That's how you have to do it. If you notice somebody you think is a victim of domestic violence, figure out somehow some way to get through to them. If you notice a kid that is off and needs extra counseling or whatever, figure out how that can happen. Maybe their parents are not in the position, maybe this, maybe that. But you know, we're all connected. And as much as we're also disconnected with different countries, different values, at the same time, when it's life and death, when it's violence, when it's murder, we're all in the same boat. And let's try to find a way to keep the white light around us. And the only way to do that is to look into these stories that have happened to other people and try to take lessons from them. And that's what I am all about.
We are all connected. I cannot agree more. Thank you again so much. And y'all, I'm going to end Zone 7 the way that I always do with a quote. The serial arsonist is the most difficult to apprehend because the evidence is burned up. Joseph Wamba. I'm Cheryl McCollum, and this is Zone 7.
Do you love fashion? Do you love getting compliments on how well you're dressed? Are you always seeking the latest trends? Then we're talking to you. BostonProper.com is your fashion destination and the only place to go for all those nods, head turns, and new styles. No matter the day, season, or occasion, Boston Proper has what you're looking for. Sophisticated, confident clothing designed to flatter and get noticed. So visit BostonProper.com now and start creating your perfect wardrobe. Boston Proper. Wear it like no one else.